Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of the Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where our mission is to make visionary community change the norm in this sector rather than the exception. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. I'm so pleased to have Carol Rasko as my guest today on Making Change. Carol's experience in social change initiatives spans decades, beginning as an advocate for children with disabilities in the 1970s and 80s. Building upon what she learned from that advocacy role, Carol became a policy advisor, first to Governor and then President Bill Clinton, culminating in 4 years as the United States Domestic Policy Advisor during the Clinton administration. For almost the past decade, Carol has put her skills to work as CEO of Reading is Fundamental, the nation's largest children's literacy program. Between her experience working as an advocate from outside the system, her experience working as a policy advisor deep within the system, and now her experience working as an institutional advocate in her position at Reading is Fundamental, Carol's career has been dedicated to improving conditions in our communities. And so it is my pleasure to have Carol share her observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Carol Rasko. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you.
Your history is just so incredible, spanning a couple of decades here of constant ongoing advocacy for children's issues, for literacy issues, for disability issues. When you look back over your various roles in various places, when you look back at what it takes to create social change, what do you see happening with groups that are creating significant change? What's going on?
Well, first and foremost, I see when I look back on the finished product of the time, and I think anyone who's into social change and advocacy, it's an ongoing process. You don't say, "Okay, we're finished." But when you're trying to make the significant pieces of the change, what I see more than anything is that a real community has been formed around the issue. And it normally means you're drawing on people that would not always come together on something, either by virtue of where they live in a community or how people perceive their interest. But you're really trying to do that very thing, that you want to draw as many people as possible from as many different categories, sectors, whatever word you want to give to it, to come together on the issue. And the more major the hurdle you're trying to climb, the more of those people, it's not always so much the numbers of people, it's having these different viewpoints that you wouldn't necessarily put together in your head initially. You want a lot of different sectors that have come together. And what I also usually see, as much as that bringing together of community, is that when you get down to it, there are usually a very small number of people who have been the agitators, advocates, whatever term a person wants to use for them. I think in the more successful ones, they're not always out front. They're not always getting their name in the paper, but they're there prodding and keeping the process moving along. And in my terms, they're keeping the process honest. They're not letting it get diverted from that original vision of, we want to make significant change in welfare. We want to make significant change in how children with disabilities are incorporated into schools or into recreation. We want to make significant change in the way we look at getting children excited about reading and coupling that with the actual teaching of reading. Whatever it is we're trying to do, we need a lot of different viewpoints represented in this community of change for that particular issue.
Those are both really powerful points. Let's talk first about the advocates, agitators, organizers. Can you give an example? Because you talk about them not always being out front, but keeping that process honest. Can you share an example of what that looks like, of where you've seen that happen?
Well, I think when I look at really one of the earliest things I did that I cut my teeth on, in some senses, after college, when my first child was born and was diagnosed as cerebral palsy and moderately retarded, it was very interesting how I began to be approached by people both that I had met previously, and maybe I had worked with them on symphony work or some issue that wasn't even remotely related to children with disabilities and their education. Some of them I knew had children with disabilities. Some of them I didn't even know it was an issue they'd ever dealt with. And they were all mothers, and they approached me, and it was this wonderful, we called each other one another's kitchen cabinet, and they had varying ages of children. But they were very determined that we were going to make sure that in Arkansas we got a specific special ed law that would mirror the federal law that people were working on here in Washington, where I currently am. And it was very interesting. There was no one person in that group that was identified as the, quote, ringleader. I mean, we were just all there to see that we moved this forward. And that is when I really began to see the power of bringing all these different people together more informally than formally. But for example, we knew that teachers were very frightened about this law because they were going to be expected to incorporate the children that had never gone into their classrooms, and they weren't going to get time off to go back and take special ed courses, and that was not their major. And one of the ways we really began to incorporate teachers in this was we as parents put together the kind of training that we decided we would want someone that was going to have our children. What were some of the basic things we would want them to know? What were some of the fears we would want to do away with? And we would just call people in a town that we wanted to go to, and in a state as small as ours, we call people we'd gone to college with or to summer camps and say, can two of us come stay with you? We've offered to do this for your school, but we have no money. There's no contract that someone's paying us to do this. And those teachers became some of the greatest advocates in the state because they began to understand that we weren't there to try to catch them and say, gotcha, and we're going to take you to court because you're not assimilating our children well enough. They understood we were parents just as many of them were parents, and that we really wanted to incorporate our children and why we wanted to incorporate them. And we shared research we'd been reading. We offered to get them articles. Before we left each community, they usually were taking us to meet community leaders because they wanted those leaders to hear the story and that we weren't these mothers that were going to demand that their, quote, vegetable children had to be taught algebra 2. And it was just a matter of giving them something they needed to feel more comfortable about it. And once they saw our humanness and that we weren't out to show their deficiencies, they became some of the best advocates we could have ever had.
Isn't it interesting how we so frequently think of experts? And you're talking about the teachers being fearful that the parents would sort of show up the lack of expertise that the teachers had, when we would immediately assume that the teachers and the local leaders were the ones that have the expertise. But that expertise really is in everybody in different ways. And I'm fascinated by the fact that the parents were empowering the teachers, who then empowered the local leaders.
Right. And, I look back on all of it and I'm amazed because we really didn't have budgets that could do expensive things. But we wanted to get across because we knew, for example, for visual impairments, that most people in their subconsciousness think that you either can see or you can't see. And we know that there are gradations of that. And so it's really almost comical to look back on. We took sandwich bags and we would say, fold them over four times and put that in front of your eyes. And that was the kind of can't see at all. And then we would, one layer at a time, have them open it and begin to see that there were those gradations and that there are children that could distinguish dark and light at various levels that gave them some vision. It didn't give them the depth perception necessarily. And we get down to where there's just one layer and it's just kind of cloudy. But that one little example, you could just see light bulbs going off, and we were sitting there using the cheapest sandwich bags we could find.
As you're talking, what I'm realizing, the first thing that you mentioned is bringing lots of people together, and not necessarily a lot of people, but from very different points of view, from different locations. The sandwich bag story is such a clear indication of how we can bring together people to have them see something commonly. When you're bringing folks together from different points of view, what does it take? Aside from, in addition to the kind of analogy that you're talking about, what does it take to bring them together in the first place? And what does it take to then bring them to the point where they are finding their commonalities?
Well, in the beginning, I have always found that it takes a lot of one-on-one or one-on-three kind of thing. You can't just put out an announcement or you're asking for a catastrophe, come share your views at this meeting kind of thing. Those are, as far as I'm concerned, when you get a lot of shouting and nothing else. And so if it means that you sit and you make a list of the organized groups in a community or a state or at a national level that you think are going to have an interest in it, either positively or negatively. And I usually try to first work with those that I think are going to be rather positive so that I have some strength in numbers just backing me up or backing our group up when we start to go to the people that might be against it or that have given indication they would have problems with it. And I think it's then important to go to those sectors that you think will have problems with it and try to sit down in very small groups. You don't publicize the meeting ahead of time. You ask them to respect that you really just want to talk quietly and off the record about the issue and determine if there are places that you can agree. And going back to the disability issue, it's been such a big piece of my life. When I was on the state board in Arkansas for the MRDD board, the Mental Retardation Developmental Disabilities, when I went on that board, there were a lot of people that were very angry with the governor that he had put a person on that board who they saw as a community-based person. And back at that time, and my son is 37 years old now, people were really seen either as believing in putting children in institutions or having them grow up in the community and kind of never the twain shall meet. And so, me being put on a seven-member board and being the second person that had been put on who were raising our children at home and not in an institution, I was immediately a target, kind of the raw meat thrown out there for them to attack. And I just found that for the other members of the board and then groups that represented parents of children in institutions and things, I found that if I could sit down with them and get across that I understood they were 70 and 80-year-old parents, and that they were very frightened that an institution might be closed, and that was all their child had ever known, and they didn't have that comfort of knowing what might happen to that child, especially if the child in the institution did not have siblings that could care for them. And I found that if I could sit down and begin to show my humanity and the fact that we needed to look for these solutions together, but that we really did have a wall. It wasn't just a philosophy of how to raise the children. There was a law to be met, but that I respected their child had been raised in a very different environment than I was raising my child, and that there were surely things we could do that would be short of just closing the doors. And only now is Arkansas really beginning to implement some of those things. But that's a very slow process, because you're talking to a parent about their child, and I felt as strongly about my child and how he would be raised as they felt about theirs. And you don't solve that by having shouting matches at a board meeting in front of the press.
I'm not sure what you solve by having shouting matches in front of the press.
Me either.
Really, what you're talking about is finding that common humanity. It's the thread as you're talking through, you called them agitators and organizers, but really what you're talking about is finding the commonalities in people's humanness. When you're talking about the parents and the teachers and the local leaders, it's not parents versus teachers. You assumed that you were walking into a group that wanted to do their best and had things that were standing in the way. And I'm finding fascinating as you're talking is that you didn't focus on the things that were standing in the way. What you focused on was the assumption that you would find things in common and you would move forward together. There's such a difference when I'm hearing you talk between that shouting match mentality, which really is the assumption that we're not going to agree, compared with the assumption that we're going to meet with people that we seemingly don't agree with, but find what we do agree on. And I'm just finding that very striking in everything that you're saying.
I think it's so important to take that approach to it. I haven't run into it so much here at Reading is Fundamental, but when I did a previous literacy project during an administration here in D.C., I initially had people coming who had very distinct ideas about how you teach reading, and they were ready to pick a big fight. And what I had to first get across to them was not that we were saying from the administration, here is the only way to do it. What we were trying to do in the America Reads Challenge was look at the dismal figures that were on record that nobody disputed, and what were things that the different sectors could begin to do that potentially could make a difference, and how did we coordinate those? And I was very clear with them that I thought if our goal was that we had to all agree on which method of the teaching of reading was the proper one, that we might as well throw up our hands and say there are always going to be these huge percentages of children that won't read, and shame on us that we can't begin again to look at the things we could agree on, and that local communities were going to hash out the method piece through school boards and others. But clearly, we could all begin to agree that children needed print material in the home, and that the children who needed it most were the parents who couldn't afford it. So then you need to start looking at things like libraries and access patterns. If children who most need that free lending service don't have any public transportation that runs within a reasonable number of blocks to them to get to that library, then that's an issue that we perhaps can agree on to start to work on and getting them using the library. That we will probably accomplish far more there in building steps toward good literacy for children than we will if we spend days and days and days fighting over which method. And part of my belief there is, having taught school and being trained as a teacher, the best training you get tells you you need to look at the individual child and their needs. That's the thing you do with children that are, quote, special needs or special education. But making sure these children can get to where there are books is a really critical issue. So let's work on that first, and we'll begin to see each other in a different light.
I'm listening to you say, looking at the individual child and their needs. It's really what you're talking about doing when you're working with groups that may or may not agree on things. You're looking at those individual groups and the individuals who comprise those groups and really looking at what their needs are, which is another way of finding that common humanity.
Right. And as I looked over the Pollyanna principles last night, the number five, building on our strengths, because I think often the shouting matches come when we believe there are weaknesses in other viewpoints, or that human nature brings about. So let's dwell on those differences, but we can build the strength by building on those things that we can agree on initially. And as we come to know one another, we're probably going to work through many more things than if we had started with the number one thing we can't agree on.
The assumptions really undergird everything. It's energizing to listen to you so consistently talk about and evidence that it really is the assumptions that we bring into the room. If we assume we're going to disagree, isn't it amazing that we disagree?
Absolutely.
And if we assume that we're going to find agreement, we do. And it's wonderful to hear the stories that you're telling, because it really reinforces that it really is about what we bring into the room when we're meeting. And when we bring that positive approach, then we're able to quietly advocate and powerfully advocate with folks that we may on the surface not necessarily agree with.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Carol, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you. And in the last couple of moments we've got, is there anything exciting that you have on the burner at Reading is Fundamental that you'd like to share with us? I know that you had spoken with me at one point about DC being a laboratory for the work that you're doing. And if there's anything you'd like to share with us in our last few minutes, I'd love to hear what you guys are up to.
Well, the DC Public Schools are a laboratory for our national office. We were founded here in DC, and I realized that we had people on staff who had very critical functions to making the program work nationally, but they really had no clue what it is RIF is doing programmatically out there. So we asked the superintendent if we could give the children of DC a gift during our 40th year, and we're in our 44th year, we'll be turning 45 next fall. And that we would go in and organize the RIF program with a teacher or other designated person in each school that participates. And we have close to 50 schools we're going into here. And we close down on the three distribution days throughout the year. And staff from here go out and work with the designated teacher in each school. We recruit volunteers. And it really is a better morale booster than anything else I could do, I think, because people come back so excited, having seen the kind of things they've heard, those of us that do get to go out more often and see these things. And they see that children are incredulous that they're going to get to keep this book that they just chose, and that we even help them get their name written in it to show that ownership. And that kind of excitement on the part of the children and the genuine interest, please sit down and read this story with me. Or last time I got this book and I've helped my brothers and sisters read it, and now my cousins are reading it. Those kind of things build morale around here, again, more than anything I could go out and purchase. And it's been very exciting. Plus, the people that work in what I call the technical aspects of book ordering and the finance department, all that, they get a chance to visit with the people that are on the ground carrying this out. And they often come back and think it through and come up with better processes that will save those teachers and administrators time. So it's a mutual admiration society. We're now all working with each other.
Isn't it amazing what happens when we get out and connect with the people that we're working closely with, that sometimes the internet and the phone do us a disservice because we never actually get to touch each other and see the good work we're doing and the difference we're making. You're absolutely right. It's probably the best antidote to burnout that there is.
Absolutely.
Well, Carol, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your energy here with us. I hope you'll join us again soon to share more about what you're doing. We so appreciate your being here with us on Making Change.
Thank you.
Speaking with Carol, it's easy to connect the dots between what we think and what we do, the assumptions we make, the beliefs we hold. When we assume we're walking into a room where everyone disagrees, we bring that disagreement with us even before we've entered the room. But when we walk into that same room with those same people and realize that we all want pretty much the same thing for our communities, healthy, vibrant, humane, resilient places to live, we find there's a ton for us to build upon together. Whichever point of view we believe we will encounter not only guides how we engage with others, but actually sets the tone for how they engage with us. The power of that seemingly simple reality can't be overstated. When we believe we have a shared desire for a positive end result, we create an environment that sets the stage for finding common ground. Imagine, then, the power of community conversations held from the point of view that Carol shared, a point of view that assumes we all want to build strong, resilient, healthy communities. Imagine the power of community conversations that then ask, if that's what we all want, how can we work together to achieve that? No need for hashing out what doesn't fit, because we're aimed at what we all want together. From there, Carol's stories raise many questions for the conversations we're all currently engaged in our communities. How do our beliefs create our reality? If we changed those beliefs, is it possible we'd find commonality rather than differences? Is this simple assumption that we all want healthy, vibrant places to live the first big step towards the civil discourse we all crave? And if so, could we experiment to begin every conversation just as Carol did, at the point where we all agree? If you're interested in exploring these questions, please join us at the Chronicle of Philanthropy's group at LinkedIn. If you're not already a member at LinkedIn or a member of the Chronicle of Philanthropy's group, please sign up and join us. The conversation generated by these podcasts is always lively. And you can always find great ways to connect as well, plus other terrific information, at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, or follow the Chronicle on Twitter at philanthropy. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me on Twitter. I'm at Hilde Gottlieb, or at our website, creatingthefuture.org. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.